My face was distorted, like someone had pulled it down on one side, and there was a scar to the side of my left eye. "Who did this to me?" I wrote. My letters still scrambled. I wanted to know who had done this. What happened to me? I also wrote, "Stop lights," as the bright lights were making my head ache. "Something bad happened to you," said Dr. Fiona. "Was I shot? Was my father shot?" I wrote. She told me that I had been shot on the school bus. She said two of my friends on the bus had also been shot, but I didn't recognize their names. She explained that the bullet had entered through the side of my left eye where there was a scar, traveled 18 inches down to my left shoulder, and stopped there. It could have taken out my eye or gone into my brain. It was a miracle I was alive. I felt nothing, maybe just a bit satisfied, so they did it. My only regret was that I hadn't had a chance to speak to them before they shot me. Now they'd never hear what I had to say. I didn't even think a single bad thought about the man who shot me. I had no thoughts of revenge. I just wanted to go back to Swat. I wanted to go home. After that, images started to swim around in my head, but I wasn't sure what was a dream and what was reality. The story I remember of being shot is quite different from what really happened. I was in another school bus with my father and friends and another girl called Gul. We were on our way home when suddenly two Taliban appeared dressed in black. One of them put a gun to my head and the small bullet that came out of it entered my body. In this dream, he also shot my father. Then everything is dark. I'm lying on a stretcher, and there's a crowd of men, a lot of men, and my eyes are searching for my father. Finally I see him, and try to talk to him, but I can't get the words out. Other times, I'm in a lot of places, in Jinnah Market in Islamabad, in China Bazaar, and I am shot. I even dreamed that the doctors were Taliban. As I grew more alert, I wanted more details. People coming in were not allowed to bring their phones, but Dr. Fiona always had her iPhone with her because she's an emergency doctor. When she put it down, I grabbed it to search for my name on Google. It was hard as my double vision meant I kept typing in the wrong letters. I also wanted to check my email, but I couldn't remember the password. On the fifth day, I got my voice back, but it sounded like someone else. When Rehana came in, we talked about the shooting from an Islamic perspective. "They shot at me," I told her. "Yes, that's right," she replied. "Too many people in the Muslim world can't believe a Muslim can do such a thing," she said. "My mother, for example, would say they can't be Muslims. Some people call themselves Muslims, but their actions are not Islamic." We talked about how things happen for different reasons. This happened to me, and how education for females, not just males, is one of our Islamic rights. I was speaking up for my right as a Muslim woman to be able to go to school. Once I got my voice back, I talked to my parents on Dr. Javed's phone. I was worried about sounding strange. "Do I sound different?" I asked my father. "No," he said. "You sound the same, and your voice will only get better." "Are you okay?" he asked. "Yes," I replied, "but this headache is so severe, I can't bear the pain." My father got really worried. I think he ended up with a bigger headache than me. In all the calls after that, he would ask, "Is the headache increasing or decreasing?" After that, I just said to him, "I'm okay." I didn't want to upset him and didn't complain, even when they took the staples from my head and gave me big injections in my neck. "When are you coming?" I kept asking. By then, they had been stuck in the army hostel at the hospital in Rawalpindi for a week, with no news about when they might come to Birmingham. My mother was so desperate that she told my father, "If there is no news by tomorrow, I will go on a hunger strike." Later that day, My father went to see the major in charge of security and told him. The major looked alarmed. Within 10 minutes, my father was told arrangements would be made for them to move to Islamabad later that day. Surely there they could arrange everything. When my father returned to my mother, he said to her, "You are a great woman. All along I thought Malala and I were the campaigners, but you really know how to protest." They were moved to Kashmir House in Islamabad, a hostel for members of parliament. Security was still so tight that when my father asked for a barber to give him a shave, a policeman sat with them all the way through so the man wouldn't cut his throat. At least now they had their phones back and we could speak more easily. Each time Dr. Javed would call my father in advance to tell him what time he could speak to me and to make sure he was free. But when the doctor called, the line was usually busy. My father is always on the phone. I rattled off my mother's 11-digit mobile number, and Dr. Javed looked astonished. He knew then that my memory was fine. But my parents were still in darkness about why they weren't flying to me. Dr. Javed was also baffled why they weren't coming. When they said they didn't know, he made a call and then assured them the problem was not with the army, but the civilian government. Later, they would discover that rather than do whatever it took to get my parents on the first plane to Birmingham to join their sick daughter, the Interior Minister Reham Malik was hoping to fly with them so they could have a joint press conference at the hospital, and it was taking some time to make the arrangements. He also wanted to make sure they didn't ask for political asylum in Britain, which would be embarrassing for his government. Eventually, he asked my parents outright if this was their plan. It was funny because my mother had no idea what asylum was, and my father had never even thought about it. There were other things on his mind. When my parents moved to Kashmir House, they were visited by Sonia Shahid, the mother of Shiza, our friend who had arranged the trip for all us Khushal schoolgirls to Islamabad. She had assumed they had gone to the UK with me, and when she found out they were still in Pakistan, she was horrified. They said they had been told there were no plane tickets to Birmingham. Sonia brought them clothes, as they had left everything in Swat, and got my father the number for President Zardari's office. He called and left a message. That night, the president spoke to him and promised everything would be sorted out. "I know what it's like to be kept from one's children," he said, referring to his years in jail. When I heard they would be in Birmingham in 2 days, I had one request. "Bring my school bag," I pleaded to my father. "If you can't go to Swat to fetch it, no matter, buy new books for me, because in March it's my board examination." Of course I wanted to come first in class. I especially wanted my physics book, because physics is difficult for me, and I needed to practice numericals as my maths is not so good, and they are hard for me to solve. I thought I'd be back home by November. It ended up being 10 days before my parents came. Those 10 days I spent in hospital without them felt like 100 days. It was boring, and I wasn't sleeping well. I stared at the clock in my room. The changing time reassured me I was alive, and I saw for the first time in my life I was waking early. Every morning, I longed for 7 a.m. when the nurses would come. The nurses and Dr. Fiona played games with me. QEH is not a children's hospital, so they brought over a play coordinator with games. One of my favorites was Connect Four. I usually drew with Dr. Fiona, but I could beat everyone else. The nurses and hospital staff felt sorry for me in a far-off land away from my family and were very kind, particularly Ema Chowdhury, the jolly director of operations, and Julie Tracy, the head nurse who would sit and hold my hand. The only thing I had with me from Pakistan was a beige shawl which Colonel Junaid had given to Dr. Fiona as a present for me, so they went clothes shopping to buy me things. They had no idea how conservative I was, or what a teenage girl from the Swat Valley would wear. They went to Next and British Home Stores, and came back with bags of t-shirts, pajamas, socks, and even bras. Ima asked me if I would like shalwar kameez, and I nodded. "What's your favorite color?" she asked. "Pink," was of course my reply. They were worried I wasn't eating, but I didn't like the hospital food, and I was worried it was not halal. The only things I'd eat there were the nutritional milkshakes. Nurse Julie discovered I liked cheesy watsits, so brought me those. "What do you like?" they asked me. "Fried chicken," I replied. Ima discovered there was a halal Kentucky Fried Chicken at Small Heath, so would go there every afternoon to buy me chicken and chips. One day, she even cooked me a curry. To keep me occupied, they brought me a DVD player. One of the first movies they got me was Bend It Like Beckham. Thinking the story of a Sikh girl challenging her cultural norms and playing football would appeal to me. I was shocked when the girls took off their shirts to practice in sport bras, and I made the nurses switch it off. After that, they brought cartoons and Disney movies. I watched all three Shrek movies and A Shark's Tale. My left eye was still blurry, so I covered it when I watched, and my left ear would bleed, so I had to keep putting in cotton wool balls. One day I asked a nurse, "What is this lump?" placing her hand on my tummy. My stomach was big and hard, and I didn't know why. "It's the top of your skull," she replied. I was shocked. After I started to speak, I also walked again for the first time. I hadn't felt any problem with my arms or legs in bed, apart from my left hand, which was stiff because the bullet had ended up by my shoulder, so didn't realize I couldn't walk properly. My first few steps were such hard work, it felt like I'd run 100 kilometers. The doctors told me I would be fine. I just needed lots of physiotherapy to get my muscles working again. One day, another Fiona came, Fiona Alexander, who told me she was in charge of the hospital press office. I thought this was funny. I couldn't imagine Swat Central Hospital having a press office. Until she came, I had no idea of the attention I'd attracted. When I was flown from Pakistan, there was supposed to be a news blackout, but photographs were leaked from Pakistan of me leaving and saying I was going to the UK, and the media soon found out my destination was Birmingham. A Sky News helicopter was soon circling above, and as many as 250 journalists came to the hospital from as far away as Australia and Japan. Fiona Alexander had spent 20 years as a journalist herself and had been editor of the Birmingham Post, so she knew exactly how to feed them material and stop them trying to get in. The hospital started giving daily news briefings on my condition. People just turned up wanting to see me. Government ministers, diplomats, politicians, even an envoy from the Archbishop of Canterbury. Most brought bouquets, some of them exquisitely beautiful. One day, Fiona Alexander brought me a bag of cards and toys and pictures. It was Eid al-Adha, Big Eid, our main religious holiday, so I thought maybe some Muslims had sent them. Then I saw the postage dates from 10th October, 11th October, days before, and I realized it was nothing to do with Eid. They were from people all over the world wishing me a speedy recovery, many of them school children. I was astonished, and Fiona laughed. "You haven't seen anything yet." She told me there were sacks and sacks more, about 8,000 cards in total, many just addressed Malala Birmingham Hospital. One was even addressed the girl shot in the head, Birmingham. Yet it had got there. There were offers to adopt me as if I had no family and even a marriage proposal. Rehana told me that thousands and millions of people and children around the world had supported me and prayed for me. Then I realized that people had saved my life. I had been spared for a reason. People had sent other presents too. There were boxes and boxes of chocolates and teddy bears of every shape and size. Most precious of all, perhaps, was the parcel that came from Benazir Bhutto's children, Bilawal and Bakhtawa. Inside were two shawls that had belonged to their late mother. I buried my nose in them to try and smell her perfume. Later, I found a long black hair on one of them, which made it even more special. I realized what the Taliban had done was make my campaign global. While I was lying in that bed waiting to take my first steps in a new world, Gordon Brown, the UN Special Envoy for Education and former Prime Minister of Britain, had launched a petition under the slogan, "I am Malala," to demand no child be denied a school by 2015. There were messages from heads of state and ministers and movie stars, and one from the granddaughter of Sir Olaf Caro, the last British governor of our province. She said she was ashamed at not being to read and write Pashto, although her grandfather had been fluent. Beyoncé had written me a card and posted a photo of it on Facebook. Selena Gomez had tweeted about me, and Madonna had dedicated a song. There was even a message from my favorite actress and social activist, Angelina Jolie. I couldn't wait to tell Moniba. I didn't realize then I wouldn't be going home. 24. They have snatched her smile. The day my parents flew to Birmingham, I was moved out of intensive care and into room 4, ward 519, which had windows, so I could look out and see England for the first time. "Where are the mountains?" I asked. It was misty and rainy, so I thought maybe they were hidden. I didn't know then that this was a land of little sun. All I could see were houses and streets. The houses were red brick and all looked exactly the same. Everything looked very calm and organized, and it was odd to see people's lives going on as if nothing had happened. Dr. Javed told me my parents were coming and tilted my bed so that I was sitting up to greet them when they arrived. I was so excited. In the 16 days since that morning when I had run out of our house in Mingora shouting goodbye, I had been in 4 hospitals and traveled thousands of miles. It felt like 16 years. Then the door opened, and there were the familiar voices saying Jani and Pisho, and they were there, kissing my hands, as they were frightened to touch me. I couldn't control myself and wept as loudly as I could. All that time alone in hospital, I hadn't cried, even when I had all those injections in my neck or the staples removed from my head. But now, I could not stop. My father and mother were also weeping. It was as if all the weight had been lifted from my heart. I felt that everything would be fine now. I was even happy to see my brother Khushal, as I needed someone to fight with. "We missed you, Malala," said my brothers, though they were soon more interested in all the teddies and gifts. And Khushal and I were soon fighting again when he took my laptop to play games on. I was shocked by my parents' appearance. They were tired from the long flight from Pakistan, but that wasn't all. They looked older, and I could see they both had grey hairs. They tried to hide it, but I could see they were also disturbed by how I looked. Before they came in, Dr. Javed had warned them, "The girl you will see is only 10% recovered. There is still 90% to go." But they had no idea that half my face was not working and that I couldn't smile. My left eye bulged. Half my hair was gone, and my mouth tilted to one side as if it had been pulled down, so when I tried to smile, it looked more like a grimace. It was as if my brain had forgotten it had a left face. I also couldn't hear from one side, and I spoke in baby language as if I was a small child. My parents were put in a hostel in the university among all the students. The people in charge of the hospital thought it might be difficult for them to stay at the hospital because they would be besieged by journalists, and they wanted to protect us at this critical stage in my recovery. They had very little with them, except the clothes they were wearing and what Shiza's mother, Sonia, had given them, because when they left Swat on 9th October, they had no idea they wouldn't be going back. When they returned to the hostel room, they cried like children. I had always been such a happy child. My father would boast to people about my heavenly smile and heavenly laughter. Now he lamented to my mother, "That beautiful symmetrical face, that bright shining face has gone. She's lost her smile and her laughter. The Taliban are very cruel. They have snatched her smile," he added. "You can give someone eyes or lungs, but you cannot restore their smile." The problem was a facial nerve. The doctors were not sure at that point if it was damaged and might repair itself, or was cut. I reassured my mother that it didn't matter to me if my face was not symmetrical. Me, who had always cared about my appearance, how my hair looked. But when you see death, things change. "It doesn't matter if I can't smile or blink properly," I told her. "I'm still me, Malala. The important thing is, God has given me my life." Yet every time they came to the hospital and I laughed or tried to smile, my mother's face would darken, as if a shadow had crossed it. It was like a reverse mirror. When there was laughter on my face, there was distress on my mother's. My father would look towards my mother, who had this big question in her eyes. Why was Malala like this? The girl she had brought into the world and for 15 years had been smiling. One day my father asked her, "Pekai, tell me truthfully, what do you think? Is it my fault?" "No, Kaista," she replied. "You didn't send Malala out thieving or killing or to commit crimes. It was a noble cause." Even so, my father worried that in future every time I smiled, it would be a reminder of the shooting. That was not the only way they found me changed. Back in Swat, I used to be a very fragile and sensitive child who would cry at the slightest thing. But in hospital in Birmingham, even when I was in terrible pain, I did not complain. The hospital refused to allow other visitors, even though they were inundated by requests, as they wanted me to be able to concentrate on my rehabilitation in private. 4 days after my parents arrived, a group of politicians came to the hospital from the three countries that had helped me. Rehman Malik, Pakistan's interior minister, William Hague, the British foreign minister, and Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed, foreign minister of the UAE. They were not allowed to see me, but were briefed by doctors and met my father. He was upset by the minister's visit, because Rehman Malik said to him, "Tell Malala she should give a smile to the nation." He did not know that that was the one thing I could not do. Rehman Malik had revealed that my attacker was a Talib called Ataullah Khan, who he said had been arrested in 2009 during the military operation in Swat, but freed after 3 months. There were media reports that he had done a physics degree at Sehanzeb College. Malik claimed the plan to shoot me was hatched in Afghanistan. He said he had put a $1 million bounty on the head of Ataullah and promised they would find him. We doubted that, as no one has ever been caught. Not the killer of Benazir Bhutto. Not whoever was behind the plane crash that killed General Zia. Not the assassin of our Prime Minister, Liaquat Ali Khan. Only 2 people had been arrested after my shooting. Our poor dear driver Usman Baijan and the school accountant, who had taken the call from Usman Baijan to say what had happened. He was released after a few days, but Usman Baijan was still in army custody, as they said they would need him to identify people. We were very upset about that. Why had they arrested Usman Baijan and not Ataullah? The United Nations announced they were designating 10th November, 1 month and a day after the shooting, Malala Day. I didn't pay much attention, as I was preparing for a big operation the following day to repair my facial nerve. The doctors had done tests with electrical impulses, and it had not responded, so they concluded it was cut, and they needed to operate soon, or my face would remain paralyzed. The hospital had been giving regular updates to journalists about how I was doing, but did not tell them about this to keep it private. I was taken into theater on 11th November for a surgeon called Richard Irving to carry out the operation. He had explained to me that this nerve controlled the sight of my face, and its job was to open and close my left eye, move my nose, raise my left eyebrow, and make me smile. Repairing the nerve was such delicate work that it took 8.5 hours. The surgeon first cleared my ear canal of scar tissue and bone fragments and discovered that my left eardrum was damaged. Then he followed the facial nerve from the temporal bone where it enters the skull all the way to its exit, and on the way removed many more fragments of bone which had been restricting my jaw movement. He found 2 centimeters of my nerve completely missing where it leaves the skull and rerouted it in front of my ear from its normal passage behind the ear to make up for the gap. The operation went well, though it was a 3-month wait before the left side of my face started working bit by bit. I had to do facial exercises every day in front of my small mirror. Mr. Irving told me that after 6 months, the nerve would start working, though I would never be completely the same. To my delight, I could soon smile and wrinkle my eye, and week by week, my parents saw more movement coming into my face. Though it was my face, I could see it was my parents who were happiest to have it back. Afterwards, Mr. Irvin said it was the best outcome he had seen in 20 years of facial nerve surgery, and it was 86% recovered. The other good result was that finally my headaches lifted and I started reading again. I began with The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, one of a pile of books sent to me by Gordon Brown. I loved reading about Dorothy and how even though she was trying to get back home, she stopped and helped those in need like the Cowardly Lion and the Rusty Tin Man. She had to overcome a lot of obstacles to get where she was going, and I thought, if you want to achieve a goal, there will be hurdles in your way, but you must continue. I was so excited by the book that I read it quickly and afterwards told my father all about it. He was very happy because he thought, if I could memorize and narrate such detail, then my memory must be fine. I knew my parents were worried about my memory, as I told them I didn't remember anything about the shooting and kept forgetting the names of my friends. They weren't very subtle. One day my father asked, "Malala, can you sing us some Pashto Tape?" I sang a verse we liked. "When you start your journey from the end of a snake's tail, you will end up on its head in an ocean of poison." To us, that referred to how the authorities in Pakistan had initially used the militants and now were in a mess of their own making. Then I said, "Actually, there's a tapa I want to rewrite." My father looked intrigued. "Tape are the centuries-old collected wisdom of our society. You don't change them." "Which one?" he asked. "This one," I said. "If the men cannot win the battle, O my country, then the women will come forth and win you an honor." I wanted to change it to, "Whether the men are winning or losing the battle, O my country, the women are coming and the women will win you an honor." He laughed and repeated the story to everyone as he always does. I worked hard in the gym and with the physiotherapist to get my arms and legs working properly again, and was rewarded on 6th December with my first trip out of the hospital. I told Imma that I loved nature, so she arranged for 2 staff to take me and my mother on an outing to the Birmingham Botanical Gardens, not far from the hospital. They didn't let my father come, as they thought he would be recognized having been in the media a lot. Even so, I was very happy. My first time back in the outside world, seeing Birmingham and England. They told me to sit in the back of the car in the middle, not next to a window, which was annoying as I wanted to see everything in this new country. I didn't realize they were trying to protect my head from any bump. When we entered the garden and I saw all the green plants and trees, it was a powerful reminder of home. I kept saying, "This one is in my valley, and we also have this one." I am very proud of the beautiful plants of my valley. It was odd seeing all the other visitors for whom it was just a normal day out. I felt like Dorothy at the end of her journey. My mother was so excited, she called my father. "For the first time, I am happy," she said. But it was ice cold, and so we went into the cafe and had delicious tea and cakes, something called a cream tea. 2 days after that, I had my first visitor from outside the family, the president of Pakistan, Asif Zardari. The hospital did not want him to come, as they knew it would mean a media frenzy. But it was difficult for my father to refuse. Not only was Mr. Zardari our head of state, but he had said the government would pay all my medical bills, which would end up being around £200,000. They had also rented an apartment for my parents in the center of Birmingham so they could move out of the hostel. The visit was on Saturday, 8th December, and the whole thing was like something out of a James Bond movie. There were a lot of journalists gathered outside from early on, who naturally assumed the president would be brought to me in the hospital. Instead, I was wrapped up in a big purple parka with the hood, taken down through the staff entrance and driven to the hospital offices. We drove right past journalists and photographers, some of whom were up in trees, and they did not even notice. Then I sat and waited in an office, playing a game called Elf Bowling on the computer, and beating my brother Atal, even though it was the first time I had played it. When Zardari and his party arrived in two cars, they were brought in through the back. He came with about 10 people, including his chief of staff, his military secretary, and the Pakistan High Commissioner in London, who had taken over from Dr. Fiona as my official guardian in the UK till my parents arrived. The president was first briefed by doctors, not to mention my face. Then he came in to see me with his youngest daughter, Asifa, who is a few years older than me. They brought me a bouquet of flowers. He touched my head, which is our tradition. But my father was worried, as I had nothing but skin, no bone to protect my brain, and my head beneath the shawl was concave. Afterwards, the president sat with my father, who told him that we were fortunate I had been brought to the UK. She might have survived in Pakistan, but she wouldn't have had the rehabilitation and would have been disfigured, he said. Now her smile will return. Mr. Zardari told the High Commissioner to give my father a post as education attaché so he would have a salary to live on and a diplomatic passport so he would not need to seek asylum to stay in the UK. My father was relieved, as he was wondering how he would pay for things. Gordon Brown, in his UN role, had also asked him to be his advisor, an unpaid position, and the president said that was fine, he could be both. After the meeting, Mr. Zardari described me to the media as a remarkable girl and a credit to Pakistan. But still not everyone in Pakistan was so positive. Though my father had tried to keep it from me, I knew some people were saying he had shot me, or that I wasn't shot at all, and we had staged it so we could live overseas. The new year of 2013 was a happy one. When I was discharged from hospital in early January, finally to live with my family again. The Pakistan High Commission had rented two serviced apartments for us in a building in a modern square in the center of Birmingham. The apartments were on the 10th floor, which was higher than any of us had ever been before. I teased my mother, as after the earthquake when we were in a three-story building, she said she would never again live in an apartment block. My father told me that when they arrived, she had been so scared that she had said, "I will die in this lift." We were so happy to be a family again. My brother Khushal was as annoying as always. The boys were bored cooped up waiting for me to recover, away from school and their friends, though Atal was excited by everything new. I quickly realized I could treat them how I liked and I wouldn't get told off. It was a cold winter, and as I watched the snow falling outside through the big glass windows, I wished I could run around and chase the snowflakes like we used to back home. Sometimes we went for walks to build up my strength, though I tired easily. In the square was a fountain and a Costa coffee bar with glass walls through which you could see men and women chatting and mixing in a way that would be unthinkable in Swat. The apartment was near a famous road of shops and clubs called Broad Street. We went to the shops, though I still did not like shopping. At night, our eyes were all out on stalks at the skimpy clothes that women wore, tiny shorts almost like knickers, and bare legs on the highest heels even in the middle of winter. My mother was so horrified that she cried, "Ghar ka shoma, I'm drowning," and begged my father, "Please take me to Dubai, I can't live here." Later, we laughed about it. "Are their legs made of iron so they don't feel cold?" asked my mother. We were warned not to be out late on Broad Street on weekend nights, as it could be dangerous. This made us laugh. How could it be unsafe compared to where we had come from? Were there Taliban beheading people? I didn't tell my parents, but I flinched if an Asian-looking man came close. I thought everyone had a gun. Once a week, I Skyped my friends back in Mingora, and they told me they were still keeping a seat in class for me. My teacher had brought to class my Pakistan Studies exam from that day, the day of the shooting. I had got 75 out of 75, but as I never did the others, Malka Inur got first in class. Though I had been getting some schooling at the hospital, I worried that I was falling behind. Now the competition was between Malka Inur and Muniba. "It's boring without you to compete with," Malka Inur told me. I was getting stronger every day, but my surgery wasn't over. I still had the top of my skull missing. The doctors were also concerned about my hearing. When I went for walks, I could not understand the words of my mother and father in a crowd, and inside my ear was a tinny noise which only I could hear. On Saturday, 2nd February, I was back in QEH to be operated on, this time by a woman. Her name was Anwen White. First, she removed the skull bone from my tummy, but after looking at it, decided not to put it back as it had not kept well and there was a risk of infection. Instead, she did something called a titanium cranioplasty. I now know lots of medical terms, and fitted a special mounted titanium plate in my head with 8 screws to do the job of a skull and protect my brain. While I was in surgery, Mr. Irvin, the surgeon who had repaired my nerve, also had a solution for my damaged left eardrum. He put a small electronic device called a cochlear implant inside my head near the ear and told me that in a month they would fit the external part on my head, and then I should be able to hear. I was in theater 5 hours, and I'd had 3 operations, but I didn't feel like I'd had major surgery and was back in the apartment within 5 days. A few weeks later, when the receiver was fitted behind my ear, my left ear heard beep, beep for the first time. To start with, everything was like a robot sound, but soon it was getting better and better. We human beings don't realize how great God is. He has given us an extraordinary brain and a sensitive, loving heart. He has blessed us with 2 lips to talk and express our feelings, 2 eyes which see a world of colors and beauty, 2 feet which walk on the road of life, 2 hands to work for us, a nose which smells the beauty of fragrance, and 2 ears to hear the words of love. As I found with my ear, no one knows how much power they have in their each and every organ until they lose one. I thank Allah for the hard-working doctors, for my recovery, and for sending us to this world where we may struggle for our survival. Some people choose good ways and some choose bad ways. One person's bullet hit me. It swelled my brain, stole my hearing, and cut the nerve of my left face in the space of a second. And after that 1 second, There were millions of people praying for my life and talented doctors who gave me my own body back. I was a good girl. In my heart, I had only the desire to help people. It wasn't about the awards or the money. I always prayed to God, I want to help people, and please help me to do that. A Talib fires 3 shots at point-blank range at 3 girls in a van and doesn't kill any of them. This seems an unlikely story, and people say I have made a miraculous recovery. My friend Shazia, who was hit twice, was offered a scholarship at Atlantic College in Wales, so has come to the UK for schooling, and I hope Kenneth will too. I know God stopped me from going to the grave. It feels like this life is a second life. People prayed to God to spare me, and I was spared for a reason, to use my life for helping people. When people talk about the way I was shot and what happened, I think it's the story of Malala, a girl shot by the Taliban. I don't feel it's a story about me at all. Epilogue. One child, one teacher, one book, one pen. Birmingham, August 2013. In March, we moved from the apartment to a rented house on a leafy street. But it feels as if we are camping in it. All our belongings are still in Swat. Everywhere there are cardboard boxes full of the kind letters and cards that people send. And in one room stands a piano none of us can play. My mother complains about the murals of Greek gods on the walls and carved cherubs on the ceilings watching her. Our house feels big and empty. It sits behind an electric iron gate, and it sometimes seems as if we are in what we in Pakistan call a sub-jail, a kind of luxury house arrest. At the back, there is a large garden with lots of trees and a green lawn for me and my brothers to play cricket on. But there are no rooftops to play on, no children fighting with kites in the streets, no neighbors coming in to borrow a plate of rice or for us to ask for 3 tomatoes. We are just a wall's distance from the next house, but it feels miles away. If I look out, I see my mother wandering around the garden, her head covered by a shawl, feeding the birds. She looks as if she's singing. Maybe that tapa she likes. Don't kill doves in the garden. You kill one, and the others won't come. She's giving the birds the remains of our dinner from the night before, and there are tears in her eyes. We eat much the same here as we did back home. Rice and meat for lunch and dinner, while breakfast is fried eggs, chapatis, and sometimes also honey, a tradition started by my little brother Atal, though his favorite Birmingham discovery is Nutella sandwiches. But there are always leftovers. My mother is sad about the waste of food. I know she's remembering all the children we fed in our house so they would not go to school on an empty stomach, and wondering how they are faring now. When I came home from school in Mingora, I never found my house without people in it. Now, I can't believe that I used to plead for a day of peace and some privacy to do my schoolwork. Here, the only sound is of the birds and Hushal's Xbox. I sit alone in my room doing a jigsaw puzzle and long for guests. We didn't have much money, and my parents knew what it was like to be hungry. My mother never turned anyone away. Once a poor woman came, hot, hungry, and thirsty, to our door. My mother let her in and gave her food, and the woman was so happy. I touched every door in the Mohalla, and this was the only one open, she said. May God always keep your door open wherever you are. I know my mother is lonely. She was very sociable. All the women of the neighborhood used to gather in the afternoons on our back porch, and women who worked in other houses came to rest. Now she is always on the phone to everyone back home. It's hard for her here, as she does not speak any English. Our house has all these facilities, but when she arrived, they were all mysteries to her, and someone had to show us how to use the oven, washing machine, and the TV. As usual, my father doesn't help in the kitchen. I tease him. Abba, you talk of women's rights, but my mother manages everything. You don't even clear the tea things. There are buses and trains, but we are unsure about using them. My mother misses going shopping in China Bazaar. She is happier since my cousin Shah came to stay. He has a car and takes her shopping, but it's not the same, as she can't talk to her friends and neighbors about what she bought. A door bangs in the house and my mother jumps. She jumps these days at the slightest noise. She often cries, then hugs me. Malala is alive, she says. Now, she treats me as if I were her youngest rather than eldest child. I know my father cries too. He cries when I push my hair to the side and he sees the scar on my head. And he cries when he wakes from an afternoon nap to hear his children's voices in the garden and realizes with relief that one of them is still mine. He knows people say it's his fault that I was shot, that he pushed me to speak up, like a tennis dad trying to create a champion, as if I don't have a mind of my own. It's hard for him. All he worked for over almost 20 years, has been left behind. The school he built up from nothing, which now has 3 buildings, with 1,100 pupils and 70 teachers. I know he felt proud at what he had created. A poor boy from that narrow village between the black and white mountains. He says, it's as if you planted a tree and nurtured it. You have the right to sit in its shade. His dream in life was to have a very big school in Swat, providing quality education, to live peacefully, and to have democracy in our country. In Swat, he had achieved respect and status in society through his activities and the help he gave people. He never imagined living abroad. And he gets upset when people suggest we wanted to come to the UK. A person who has 18 years of education, a nice life, a family, you throw him out just as you throw a fish out of water for speaking up for girls' education? Sometimes, he says we have gone from being IDPs to EDPs, externally displaced persons. Often over meals we talk about home and try to remember things. We miss everything, even the smelly stream. My father says, if I had known this would happen, I would have looked back for a last time, just as the Prophet did when he left Mecca to migrate to Medina. He looked back again and again. Already some of the things from Swat seem like stories from a distant place, like somewhere I have read about. My father spends much of his time going to conferences on education. I know it's odd for him, but now people want to hear him because of me, not the other way around. I used to be known as his daughter. Now he's known as my father. When he went to France to collect an award for me, he told the audience, "In my part of the world, most people are known by their sons. I am one of the few lucky fathers known by his daughter." A smart new uniform hangs on my bedroom door, bottle green instead of royal blue, for a school where no one dreams of being attacked for going to classes or someone blowing up the building. In April, I was well enough to start school in Birmingham. It's wonderful going to school and not having to feel scared as I did in Bangora, always looking around me on my way to school, terrified a Talib would jump out. It's a good school. Many subjects are the same as at home. But the teachers have PowerPoint and computers rather than chalk and blackboards. We have some different subjects, music, art, computer studies, home economics, where we learn to cook, and we do practicals in science, which is rare in Pakistan. Even though I recently got just 40% in my physics exam, it is still my favorite subject. I love learning about Newton and the basic principles the whole universe obeys. But like my mother, I am lonely. It takes time to make good friends like I had at home, and the girls at school here treat me differently. People say, "Oh, that's Malala." They see me as Malala, girls' rights activist. Back in the Khushal school, I was just Malala. the same double-jointed girl they had always known, who loved to tell jokes and drew pictures to explain things. Oh, and who was always quarreling with her brother and her best friend. I think every class has a very well-behaved girl, a very intelligent or genius girl, a very popular girl, a beautiful girl, a girl who's a bit shy, a notorious girl. But here, I haven't worked out yet who is who. As there is no one here I can tell my jokes to, I save them and tell them to Maniba when we Skype. My first question is always, what's the latest news at the school? I love to hear who is fighting with who and who got told off by which teacher. Maniba came first in class in the most recent exams. My classmates still keep a seat for me with my name on it, and at the boys' school, Sir Amjad has put a big poster of me at the entrance and says he greets it every morning before going into his office. I describe life in England to Maniba. I tell her of the streets with rows of identical houses, unlike home, where everything is different and higgledy-piggledy, and a shack of mud and stones can stand next to a house as big as a castle. I tell her how there are lovely, solid houses which could withstand floods and earthquakes, but have no flat roofs to play on. I tell her I like England because people follow rules. They respect policemen, and everything happens on time. The government is in charge, and no one needs to know the name of the army chief. I see women having jobs we couldn't imagine in Swat. They are police and security guards. They run big companies and dress exactly as they like. I don't often think about the shooting, though every day when I look in the mirror, it is a reminder. The nerve operation has done as much as it can. I will never be exactly the same. I can't blink fully, and my left eye closes a lot when I speak. My father's friend, Hidayatullah, told him we should be proud of my eye. It's the beauty of her sacrifice, he said. It is still not definitely known who shot me, but a man named Ataullah Khan said he did it. The police have not managed to find him, but they say they are investigating and want to interview me. Though I don't remember exactly what happened that day, sometimes I have flashbacks. They come unexpectedly. The worst one was in June, when we were in Abu Dhabi on the way to perform Umrah in Saudi Arabia. I went to a shopping mall with my mother as she wanted to buy a special burqa to pray in Mecca. I didn't want one. I said I would just wear my shawl, as it is not specified that a woman must wear a burqa. As we were walking through the mall, suddenly, I could see so many men around me. I thought they were waiting for me with guns and would shoot. I was terrified, though I said nothing. I told myself, Malala, you have already faced death. This is your second life. Don't be afraid. If you are afraid, you can't move forward. We believe that when we have our first sight of the Kaaba, the black shrouded cube in Mecca that is our most sacred place, any wish in your heart is granted by God. When we prayed at the Kaaba, we prayed for peace in Pakistan and for girls' education, and I was surprised to find myself in tears. But when we went to the other holy places in the desert of Mecca where the Prophet lived and preached, I was shocked that they were littered with empty bottles and biscuit wrappers. It seemed that people had neglected to preserve history. I thought they had forgotten the hadith, that cleanliness is half of faith. My world has changed so much. On the shelves of our rented living room are awards from around the world, America, India, France, Spain, Italy, and Austria, and many other places. I've even been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, the youngest person ever. When I received prizes for my work at school, I was happy as I had worked hard for them. But these prizes are different. I am grateful for them, but they only remind me how much work still needs to be done to achieve the goal of education for every boy and girl. I don't want to be thought of as the girl who was shot by the Taliban, but the girl who fought for education. This is the cause to which I want to devote my life. On my 16th birthday, I was in New York to speak at the United Nations. Standing up to address an audience inside the vast hall where so many world leaders have spoken before was daunting, but I knew what I wanted to say. "This is your chance, Malala," I said to myself. Only 400 people were sitting around me, but when I looked out, I imagined millions more. I did not write the speech only with the UN delegates in mind. I wrote it for every person around the world who could make a difference. I wanted to reach all people living in poverty, those children forced to work, and those who suffer from terrorism or lack of education. Deep in my heart, I hoped to reach every child who could take courage from my words and stand up for his or her rights. I wore one of Benazir Bhutto's white shawls over my favorite pink shalwar kameez, and I called on the world's leaders to provide free education to every child in the world. "Let us pick up our books and our pens," I said. "They are our most powerful weapons. One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world." I didn't know how my speech was received until the audience gave me a standing ovation. My mother was in tears, and my father said I had become everybody's daughter. Something else happened that day. My mother allowed herself to be publicly photographed for the first time. As she has lived her life in Purda and never unveiled her face on camera before, it was a great sacrifice and very difficult for her. At breakfast the next day, Atul said to me in the hotel, "Malala, I don't understand why you are famous. What have you done?" All the time we were in New York, he was more excited by the Statue of Liberty Central Park and his favorite game, Beyblade. After the speech, I received messages of support from all over the world. But there was mostly silence from my own country. Except that on Twitter and Facebook, we could see my own Pakistani brothers and sisters turning against me. They accused me of speaking out of a teen lust for fame. One said, "Forget the image of your country, forget about the school. She would eventually get what she was after, a life of luxury abroad." I don't mind. I know people say these things because they have seen leaders and politicians in our country who make promises they never keep. Instead, things in Pakistan are getting worse every day. The endless terrorist attacks have left the whole nation in shock. People have lost trust in each other. But I would like everyone to know that I don't want support for myself. I want the support to be for my cause of peace and education. The most surprising letter I got after my speech was from a Taliban commander who recently escaped from prison. His name was Adnan Rashid, and he used to be in the Pakistan Air Force. He had been in jail since 2003 for attempting to assassinate President Musharraf. He said the Taliban had attacked me not for my campaign for education, but because I tried to malign their efforts to establish the Islamic system. He said he was writing to me because he was shocked by my shooting and wished he could have warned me beforehand. He wrote that they would forgive me if I came back to Pakistan, wore a burqa, and went to a madrasa. Journalists urged me to answer him, but I thought, who is this man to say that? The Taliban are not our rulers. It's my life. How I live it is my choice. But Mohammed Hanif wrote an article pointing out that the good thing about the Taliban letter was that many people claim I wasn't shot, but here they were accepting responsibility. I know I will go back to Pakistan, but whenever I tell my father I want to go home, he finds excuses. "No, Jani, your treatment is not complete," he says. Or, "These schools are good. You should stay here and gather knowledge so you can use your words powerfully." He is right. I want to learn and be trained well with the weapon of knowledge. Then I will be able to fight more effectively for my cause. Today, we all know education is our basic right, not just in the West. Islam too has given us this right. Islam says every girl and every boy should go to school. In the Quran, it is written, God wants us to have knowledge. He wants us to know why the sky is blue and about oceans and stars. I know it's a big struggle. Around the world, there are 57 million children who are not in primary school, 32 million of them girls. Sadly, my own country, Pakistan, is one of the worst places. 5.1 million children don't even go to primary school, even though in our constitution it says every child has that right. We have almost 50 million illiterate adults, two-thirds of whom are women, like my own mother. Girls continue to be killed and schools blown up. In March, there was an attack on a girls' school in Karachi that we had visited. A bomb and a grenade were tossed into the school playground just as a prize-giving ceremony was about to start. The headmaster, Abdul Rashid, was killed and 8 children hurt between the ages of 5 and 10. 1 8-year-old was left disabled. When my mother heard the news, she cried and cried. When our children are sleeping, we wouldn't even disturb a hair on their heads, she said. But there are people who have guns and shoot them or hurl bombs. They don't care that their victims are children. The most shocking attack was in June in the city of Quetta, when a suicide bomber blew up a bus taking 40 pupils to their all-girls college. 14 of them were killed. The wounded were followed to the hospital, and some nurses were shot. It's not just the Taliban killing children. Sometimes it's drone attacks. Sometimes it's wars. Sometimes it's hunger. And sometimes it's their own family. In June, 2 girls my age were murdered in Gilgit, which is a little north of Swat, for posting a video online showing themselves dancing in the rain, wearing traditional dress and headscarves. Apparently their own stepbrother shot them. Today, Swat is more peaceful than other places, but there are still military everywhere, 4 years after they supposedly removed the Taliban. Fazlullah is still on the loose, and our bus driver still under house arrest. Our valley, which was once a haven for tourists, is now seen as a place of fear. Foreigners who want to visit have to get a no-objection certificate from the authorities in Islamabad. Hotels and craft shops are empty. It'll be a long time before tourists return. Over the last year, I've seen many other places, but my valley remains to me the most beautiful place in the world. I don't know when I will see it again, but I know that I will. I wonder what happened to the mango seed I planted in our garden at Ramadan. I wonder if anyone is watering it so that one day, future generations of daughters and sons can enjoy its fruit. Today, I looked at myself in a mirror and thought for a second. Once, I had asked God for 1 or 2 extra inches in height, but instead, He made me as tall as the sky, so high that I could not measure myself. So I offered the 100 rakat nafal that I had promised if I grew. I love my God. I thank my Allah. I talk to Him all day. He is the greatest. By giving me this height to reach people, He has also given me great responsibilities. Peace in every home, every street, every village, every country. This is my dream. Education for every boy and every girl in the world. To sit down on a chair and read my books with all my friends at school is my right. To see each and every human being with a smile of happiness is my wish. I am Malala. My world has changed, but I have not. You have been listening to an Orion audiobook. I Am Malala, written by Malala Yousafzai, with Christina Lam and read by Archie Punjabi, with the prologue read by Malala Yousafzai. The text is copyright 2013 Salazais Limited, and the recording is copyright 2013 by Hachette Audio. Map copyright 2013 by John Jilks. This edition is published by Orion Audiobooks and Hachette UK Company. The rights of Malala Yousafzai and Christina Lam to be identified as the authors have been asserted in accordance with the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988. The author and the publisher have made every effort to ensure that the information in this book is correct. The events, locales, and conversations are based on the author's memories of them, and any unwitting errors that may appear in the book are the author's own. Some names and identifying details have been changed to protect the privacy of individuals. Every effort has been made to fulfill requirements with regard to reproducing copyright material. The author and publisher will be glad to rectify any omissions at the earliest opportunity. For information about other Orion audiobooks, visit the website at www.orionbooks.co.uk.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.